That's readable.
Is that readable? Okay. So what we're going to be talking about here in this talk is randomness. Lots of people like to discuss randomness. People talk about bit entropy this and pseudo-random number generator that. But a lot of people seem to use a lot of the words without really knowing what they mean. Entropy is one of them. I mean, how many people actually know what entropy is? A lot of people. Okay, well, hey, that's more than in an average audience. But to the average user who says, this key has so many bits of entropy, or this system has so many bits of entropy, they don't really understand what it is. So this talk is going to explain things like that in a way that is mathematically precise, in a way that is relevant to people who are in the area of computer science, and hopefully, if I do things well, in a way that everybody will be able to understand. So if anybody has any questions at any time, just feel free to raise your hand, and if I'm not looking your way, be like, hey, over here. I'm more than happy to take questions, and if I need to explain more on something, just let me know, and I'd be more than happy to. So we're going to cover things like what random and pseudo-random mean, what quasi-random means, what exactly is entropy, and entropy in the information theory sense, not in the thermodynamic sense. We're going to cover things like explain what pseudo-random number generators are, and being able to determine whether they're good, and what exactly a good pseudo-random number generator is, because there's a lot of conflicting definitions out there for it. And the last thing I'm going to touch on is the area I'm working on the most right now, and that's ways to manipulate randomness. And randomness is something that you can actually play with. You can smooth it out if it's in chunks. You can increase it, sort of. You can get rid of it. But it's definitely something that can be watched and manipulated. So I'm going to explain some ways of how it's possible to manipulate randomness and what you can do by that manipulation. So here we are, Synintognathus crossbreeds. Well, this is how I got the title of the talk. If anybody knows Perl, it should be fairly evident what I'm doing. Actually, I didn't write this script. Somebody else was happy enough to write it for me. He just said, hey, use this. And I went, okay, sure. Basically, it just picks a random word out of the words file on a Unix system. In this case, OpenBSD. But yeah, so I pulled words at random from the words list, and then I added endings to them to make them sort of go together, sort of. But is this random? What do you guys think? Is this random?
Yes.
Yes? Is the title of my talk random at all? No? Why not? Okay. All right, well, let's start with randomness. Here's a sequence. Is this sequence random? Who here says yes? 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 is random. Who here says no? Who here has no idea and just doesn't want to participate at all? This just means it repeats ones forever. So this is completely random? Yeah? Well, in this case, you're correct. This is a completely random bit string. Except we're just picking over a set. We're picking randomly from a set of 1. So every time you pick randomly from this set, you're getting the same thing. That doesn't mean it's not random. It just means you're picking from a really bad set. So if we're talking about randomness, we need to also talk about what set we're picking from when we're generating things randomly. And, okay, here we are again. Say we're picking from the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and we get this sequence. Now is it random? Yes?
It could be.
No? Anybody? Oh, come on, let me see a show of hands here. It's only 12. You should be awake by now. You're not all that hungover. All right. So, well, people don't want to seem to say whether this is random or not. But in this case, no. Yes, it is. I'm sorry. Time for me to drink. I'm trying to get you all to respond. At least you're paying attention. Okay, well, basically we haven't defined the probability of picking each element of the set. So in this case, if we set up the probability distribution over the set to have, if you pick a 1, your probability is 1. If you pick for picking a 2, your probability is 0. For picking a 3, for picking a 4, your probability is 0. If you have that distribution over the set of things you can pick, then this is a completely random string. It's horrible because you're using a horrible distribution, but it's still completely random. So the moral of the story is you need to also look at not just the set, but the probability distribution that you're picking with. So when most people hear something is random, what they're really thinking of is uniform at random. So we can pick from any probability distribution, and nobody can really see that, can they? Okay, if you can see it, I trust you. But we can pick from any probability distribution. A probability distribution is just a collection of probabilities. So if you have a set of elements that you can pick, a probability distribution just assigns a probability of picking each element to each element. So in the previous case, if you had 1, 2, 3, 4, then as long as you have a probability on each of 1, 2, 3, 4, such that the probabilities add to 1, that's a distribution. And when most people say they want to pick something at random, what they really mean is uniform at random. And what that means is that the probability distribution is evenly divided among all elements. So if you had the elements 1, 2, 3, 4, then your probabilities would be 1 fourth, 1 fourth, 1 fourth, 1 fourth.
So is that the only way that you're allowed to assign probabilities and still call it random? Like if you assign a probability to picking a pair of numbers one after the other, that could never be called random?
If you're picking a pair of numbers, you can pick them. If they're independent, I think you're looking for independent versus dependent. If they're dependent, they're not random. If they're independent, then they can be random. Does that answer? All right, so now we get into the topic of pseudo-random number generators. And so everybody hears all about them, everybody uses them, but the question is, what exactly is a pseudo-random number generator? Fizz, can you tell me what a pseudo-random number generator is?
It's a PRNG.
Okay. So I don't know if anybody can see this that well, but all a pseudo-random number generator is a function that goes from k bits to, in this case, n bits. So it goes from a string of one size to a bit string of another size. That's all it is. And most of them are completely and totally garbage. You can't use them for anything because there are an infinite number of these functions, and almost infinity of them you can't use. So we need some properties of this function g that make it usable for this application. Particularly, we want n larger than k, because if you take 100 bits to get 50 bits, that's not really a good generator. So we want the output to be larger, and usually considerably larger than the input. We want the output to be computationally indistinguishable from random. And what that means is that somebody with all the computing resources in the world shouldn't be able to tell whether your string is output from this function or whether it was just picked completely and totally at random from some natural source. And the other property is it should be hard to predict the output even with some knowledge of the system. So you should be able to know the function and know the output and not be able to figure out the input. So what's a good way of measuring a function like this? Does anybody have any ideas? What would be a good way of evaluating a function like this to see whether it makes a good generator or a bad generator?
How many times you get the same sequence of numbers?
Okay, any other ideas? How would one evaluate a generator like this?
How big the sample is.
Okay.
K bits to n bits, how big that is.
Okay, so the increase in size.
Repeats within its n bits at all, then that should be allowed.
When it starts repeating, that's considered to be the end of the output.
Okay.
So if it only does 5 fits and then loops, it's considered 5 bits of output. Yes?
Look at the distribution of its output.
Okay, that's a good idea. Any other ideas? Okay, entropy. Well, first thing we're going to look at is statistical distance. And statistical distance is a measure of how far apart two probability distributions are. It's also known as the L1 metric. The distance between two probability distributions is that formula up there. I don't know if you guys in the back can see it or not, but it says that the distance is 1/2 of the absolute value of the sum for all x in the set of d of x minus e of x, where d and e are the two probability distributions. So you're probably wondering, you know, how the hell do you get that? That's a little too much to explain here, but it works. Trust me. So we can now measure the distance between two probability distributions, and it will give you an answer in the range of 0 to 1. If they're the same, the distance will be 0. If they're as far apart as they can be, the distance will be 1. So often we want to see how close a distribution is to uniform, because we want to see how good it is compared to something that's picked, quote unquote, at random or uniformly at random. So a lot of times we're going to be looking at distance from uniform. If the distance between a distribution and uniform is less than or equal to some epsilon, then we can say that D is epsilon close to uniform. That makes sense, because it's within epsilon of uniform. We can also say it's quasi-random within epsilon. So now we've defined quasi-randomness. As long as the distribution gives you values within some bound away from uniform, then you can say it's quasi-random. So now we get into entropy. So entropy is one of the big things that everybody knows about. Everybody's heard about bit entropy, but everybody uses it a lot, and, you know, what exactly is it? What is entropy? Is it a measure of information? Because people say, oh, I use a 128-bit entropy key, and does that mean there's 128 bits of entropy in the key? Well, does that mean there's 128 bits of information in the key? So is entropy a measure of information, or is it a measure of randomness? You know, does it say this bit is 120, this key is 128 bits random, whatever that means? Or is it a measure of redundancy? I mean, people say, oh, English has so many bits of entropy per letter. Is it a measure of the fact that English is too big, too wordy, too redundant? So which one is it? You know, is it one of these? Is it two of these? Is it all three of them? And actually, it turns out that it's sort of mostly all three. But there's also different kinds of entropy. When everybody just says entropy, what they're talking about really is Shannon entropy. But there's also Renyi entropy, there's Min entropy, and there's a whole bunch of others that I'm not even going to get into. So there are different definitions of what entropy actually is. So we'll start with the one that everybody should know, Shannon entropy. Well, not everybody should know, but the people who use it should know. Sorry. So the Shannon entropy is denoted by H, and it's often just called the entropy, and it's the basic measure of information in the system. So you use this formula here to get the Shannon entropy, and you're doing a sum for over a distribution, mind you. Like when people say, oh, this string has 128 bits of entropy in it, that's not exactly precise. Entropy is a measure of over a string, or over a distribution, rather. So you need to be looking at a distribution to be able to calculate the entropy. So if you have a distribution D, and you're looking at the entropy of the distribution, you're looking at effectively the sum of each probability times negative log base 2 of the probability. And if you think about it for a second, what this means is you're taking the probability of something coming up and more or less the size of it, or its weight, you can think of it as, and you're getting a measure based on the weights versus how much they come up. So entropy is, it's measured in bits per symbol, and where each symbol is each element in the set. And it's a measure of information. It's also a measure of randomness. And it's a measure of redundancy, because if something is random, then it's not redundant. If something is very structured, then it's extremely redundant and it's not random. So people often talk about English. English has 2.62 bits of entropy per character. So, you know, has anybody heard this before? Okay. Two people. So somebody basically, or Shannon, looked at English and looked at a whole bunch of words and found out that there were about 2.5 bits of entropy per character. And here we're looking at each character going from A to Z. We're not counting spaces or punctuation or uppercase or lowercase. We're just looking at the letters. However, if you look at the log base 2 of 26, it's more than 2 bigger, which means that there's 2 bits per character in English. On average, that's completely useless information. If you're trying to compress things, then this would show you basically how much it can be compressed. This is why English text compresses a lot better than binary files, because there's a lot of structure. And that structure is redundancy, and that redundancy is non-randomness. So this is how you would apply Shannon entropy to a system like that. Everybody with me so far? Then there's this weird thing called Renyi entropy. Okay, it's another type of entropy. What exactly does it do? Renyi entropy is concerned with how often you get a collision when picking values according to this probability distribution. So you're picking values at random over some specified probabilities, and you're wondering how often you get two values that are the same. So this little delta sub p thing up here, that's a explanation of how, or a formula for how often you get a collision. It's a sum of the squares of each probability. So if you have something that's, you know, 1/4, 1/4, 1/2, 0, you're going to get something picked twice from the first one, 1/4 times 1/4. A collision on the second one, 1/4 times 1/4. Collision on the third one, 1/2 times 1/2. And the collision on the fourth one, 0 times 0. So all you're doing is squaring the probabilities of each, because you're looking for two of them. And because they're independent, you just multiply the probabilities. So if you sum all the squares, then you get the collision probability. And then the Renyi entropy is just the negative log base 2 of this. So you're putting it in terms of bits, basically. You're looking at it over bits per symbol. So it's just a measure of how often you'll get a collision when picking according to a particular distribution. The third big one is min entropy. Min entropy can be thought of as a measure of the worst possible case of a probability distribution. So you're looking at the minimum of the negative log base 2s of the probabilities. So if you've got a probability distribution that's 1/2, 1/2, or 1/4, 1/4, 1/8, 3/8, the worst one is 3/8, so it would be negative log base 2 of that. If you're looking at something that's 1/2, 1/4, 1/4, your worst one would be 1/2, so you'd only look at that. So in the case of your worst one being 1/2, your Renyi entropy would be 1. So the reason for this might sound completely wacky and completely useless, but if you have a distribution that has one probability as 1/2 and the rest of the probabilities as extremely tiny, so you've got 100 million of these probabilities, but one of them is 1/2 and the rest sum to 1/2. So that'll have decent Shannon entropy, because, you know, all the little bits all sum up. But in the min entropy will be 1, because the worst probability is 1/2. No matter how many different ways you could possibly go with this, you're still going to get one particular value half of the time, and that's bad. So min entropy is a better measure on that. So what exists out there for measuring this randomness or determining whether something is random? In practice, there are the NIST tests. It's the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They've got a suite of 16 statistical tests that any pseudorandom number generator that they use must pass. And they run over the output of a pseudorandom number generator, And they don't actually determine whether the generator is random. They determine whether it's obviously not random. So each test has a particular area that it looks at, whether it looks, you know, whether it looks at the number of ones and zeros is skewed, or whether it, things clump too much, or whether you can approximate it using a function. Each of these 16 tests has a different use, and they all reject strings that are obviously bad. Now, these tests, if they don't reject a string, they don't say, oh yeah, that pseudorandom number generator is fine. They just say it's not bad. So you're not actually proving that something is good. You're just saying that it's not obviously bad. And there's a list of the 16 test names, just for people who are curious. All right, and that's Chewbacca. Chewbacca's a Wookiee. What a Wookiee. So, going back to pseudorandom number generators, there's a generator out there called the Nissan generator. This mathematician, computer scientist named Noam Nissan came up with this really interesting pseudorandom number generator, and I figured I'd just mention it here. So, what you're doing is you're taking an alphabet of symbols Q. So whatever these symbols are, we'll say they're bit strings to make things simpler. So Q are the symbols, and they're T bits long. And you need to pick a number of levels, K, or a number of recursive runs, to do this over. And then you need to pick functions, H1, H2, all the way up to HK, where they're basic linear functions, so AX plus B. The catch is we're doing this over a finite field. Usually we're doing it over GF 2 to the something. So the linear functions, they aren't easy to figure out all the time. So for generation, if you want to actually generate something with this pseudorandom number generator, nobody can see that. I can't see that. All right. So if you're given G0 of X, you want to return X. If you're given, this is a recursive definition, so this is the base case. G0 of X equals X. For the recursive step, what we're going to say is G to the L plus 1 of X plus L plus 1 of these H functions. So if you're at level, the subscript is the level you're at. If you're at level K, then you want to use the function will take k of these h functions. So they're linear functions. It'll take k linear functions in. So the recursive step is if you're at the L plus 1 level and you have x and L plus 1 of these linear functions, then the output of that level will be g of the level minus 1 of x and L minus 1 of these linear functions concatenated with applying the last function to x with the rest of the functions. So it's a really simple recursive definition. It's really easy to implement in software. I've done it. And the output of the generator is, for your levels, g of whatever level you're using of x and all these linear functions. So it's just another pseudorandom number generator. It takes t times 2k plus 1 bits as input. It gives you t times 2 to the k bits as output. So it's an exponential generator. It takes a linear amount of bits in, and it gives you an exponential number of bits out. And if you're a CS person, you know this is really good. So, hey, wow, this looks like a pretty cool generator. Well, the bad news is this generator is crap. It's absolute garbage in terms of keeping things secure. If you want to break it, you've got linear functions, you've got a system of linear equations, and you solve the system of linear equations. And then, oh look, you've got the whole key, you've got all of the linear functions, you've got all information on the system, you can predict the generator, you can do whatever you want. The first output of the generator is X. So X is supposed to be the seed of the generator, and the very first thing the generator spits out is always the seed. So obviously this really isn't good in practice. So that's the bad news. The good news is this generator has one very, very special property to it, and that it will fool any statistical test that requires a logarithmic number of bits in terms of the size of the string it's checking to decide on. So any statistical test, like the NIST tests, for example, that require logarithmic space will not be able to identify this as pseudorandom, despite the fact that, you know, anybody who looks at it knowing what's going on can solve the system of linear equations and figure it out. A computer working within these space requirements can't, period. It's been proven. So the bad, or the good news or the bad news is, depending on your viewpoint, is this crap generator will fool all 16 of the NIST tests every single time. Period. So pseudo-randomness, there are a lot of ways you can measure it, but a lot of the ways in practice aren't that good. And whereas somebody might say, oh, that's good enough for practice, if things aren't done according to how they can be done in theory, then one day the theory will catch up with the practice and it's all over. So there are a lot of generators out there that are bad but still look like they're good. And there are no, well, currently, that you can fingerprint them, but if a new one comes up, nobody will be able to know until it's actively fingerprinted. So beware if your statistical tests say that a pseudorandom number generator is good. This brings us into manipulating randomness. So why would we want to do this? I mean, it's randomness. It's there. It's random. What else is there to it? Why would we want to do this? Well, if you know how to manipulate randomness, then you can make better pseudorandom number generators. There are better ways of figuring out, if you can figure out how these things work and how they deal with their entropy and how they deal with their randomness and how to manipulate that randomness to change it from the way they output it to the optimal form, then you can make something that's much better. So you can create better pseudorandom number generators, and you can smooth out these bad distributions. So any probability distribution that's bad going in, you can find a way to basically take all the chunks, like the one-half probability, you can find a way to take that chunk and just sort of smooth it out over everything and be able to get a much better distribution out of it. And it only costs a couple of random bits. You can also use this for making better problems in cryptography. Right now, does anybody know what NP-complete problems are? Yes? Okay. They're the hard problems that are used in cryptography, usually. Hard. Basically, NP-complete problems are extremely hard in their worst cases. Oftentimes, you can look at an NP-complete problem and just be like, okay, that's stupid. Here's the answer. It's only on an average case that a lot of them are bad. Well, that's really bad in cryptography because we don't want certain keys to be bad. We don't want certain implementations of the system to be bad. We want it always to be hard to break. So using this manipulation of randomness, we can take a problem that is hard on average and using coding theory, using error-correcting codes, we can turn the problem into one that is hard on average. So you can take the hardness of the problem and smooth it out. Another reason you might want to do this is for de-randomization of algorithms. There are a lot of probabilistic algorithms out there that require random bits, and sometimes they might fail. But they're these magical algorithms that take random stuff in and give you an answer out faster. Sometimes they might not work because, you know, they're a box and there's magic smoke in the box and nobody really understands how they work. So there are ways, people have been finding out that a lot of these algorithms that operate with these sort of magical properties of you stick in randomness and it works, there are ways to get around this. You can always get around it if you're willing to accept a time and space trade-off. You can say, I don't want to give it any random bits, but I'm willing to stay here for much, much longer waiting for it to give me a correct answer. But people are starting to figure out ways of turning these algorithms that require random bits into ones that don't require any random bits and doing it in the same amount of time. So we're looking at trying to collapse two complexity classes on each other. And that is can be done with this manipulation of randomness. Which brings us to the big question, does P equal BPP? I'm hoping people here have heard of the P equals NP question. Computer scientists, at the very least, should know about the P equals NP question. Does P equal NP?
Yes.
Can you give me the proof?
No.
Yes, my shirt says it.
Okay, well, there's another complexity class out there that's sort of in between. Nobody knows exactly where it is in relation to P and NP, but most people sort of think it's in between P and NP. And the question is, does P equal this other complexity class, BPP? So can you do anything in probabilistic, like anything that you do in probabilistic polynomial time, can you do in deterministic polynomial time? Yes. So anything that takes random bits to do, can you do it without these random bits? And a lot of people think yes, and I'm one of them, but that's besides the point. This is one of the big questions out there right now in the areas of math, computer science, cryptography, and it's one of the things I'm working on. But how can we manipulate randomness? Well, there are these things called dispersers and extractors that I'm going to mention. There are many other ways of doing it, but this is something I'm familiar with, something that most people probably haven't heard of, so I figured I'd share it with everybody. What are they? They're a family of graphs with random-like properties. Well, what exactly does that mean? I'll explain it in a bit. What they are bipartite graphs. By bipartite, I mean they can be broken down into two chunks, so a left side and a right side, where all of the edges between vertices go from one chunk to the other chunk. So if you look at the diagram, you see the group on the left, which is N in brackets, and the group on the right, which is M in brackets. So it's a bipartite graph. N, the size of N is 2 to the little n, so 2 to the n goes to 2 to the m. M is on the right side. And each vertex on the left has degree D, capital D, where D equals 2 to the little d. So each vertex on the left has the same number of edges coming out of it going into the right. And this would make either a disperser or an extractor. It's just a graph with these properties. So here's an example of a disperser. Can people see that well, honestly? Okay. What we have here is a graph. There are four nodes in the middle and then eight on the outside. Can people see that? By not paying attention, I say yes. The inside will be counted as the left side, and the outside will be counted as the right side. So you're going from four nodes in the middle to eight nodes on the outside. In the middle, they're labeled 0001, 1011. On the outside, they're the 3-bit strings. So we're looking at 2 bits to 3 bits. And we can say a k epsilon disperser takes 2 to the k vertices at least on the middle or on the left side, and it disperses them. It pushes them out by all of these edges to almost all of the vertices on the other side. So 1 minus epsilon times the number of vertices total there. So there's a small error epsilon and a required input k. And based on that, it will take a smaller set of these vertices and push them out to a much bigger set. And that's what a disperser does. You're putting things in the middle and you're pushing them out to the outside and trying to cover everything from a smaller cover of the inside. For extractors, well, nobody can read that really. So a graph G consisting of the left side, the right side, and the edges between is a K epsilon extractor if for any probability distribution D on the left side with the min entropy greater than K, the vertices on the right side that it touches are epsilon close to uniform. And at this point, I'm pretty sure I've lost most people. So what the hell does this mean? What it means is you can stick a bad distribution on the left side. So you've got a small bunch of vertices on the left side, or even same size to same size. Let's say the two sides are equal in size. So you've got this really bad distribution on the left side. It'll give you a zero half of the time. And you really don't want to see a zero half of the time because you've got 11 billion things in this set. So it's a really big set, but you get a zero half the time. That sucks. So you're sticking that into an extractor. And this extractor will take these edges, and it will take random bits. And it'll flip a coin. And it will keep flipping a coin until it figures out which edge it wants to use. So your bad probability distribution picks a node on the left, and then your extractor flips a coin to figure out which edge it's going to take, and it gives you a node on the right. And if your graph has these properties, then you've basically just smoothed out probability distributions. You're adding a little more randomness into the system by those coin flips, but you're taking something that's really bad going in and turning it into something that's all right coming out. It might not be absolutely wonderful to use, but if you set the parameters of the graph properly, then you've got a trade-off between randomness and, you know, how many coin flips do you want to make, and these actually have to be real random bits as opposed to pseudo-random bits. How many of these coin flips do you want your computer to do versus how good do you want the output to be? And this is what an extractor does. It smooths out the probability distribution, and the input distribution is measured in terms of the min entropy of it. So you say, what's the worst case? Let's look at the worst case, and we'll only concern ourselves with that. How you measure whether the output distribution is good is how close to uniform it is. So if it's really close to uniform, it's really good. If it's very far away from uniform, it's really bad. And the really cool thing about extractors is that if you can't figure something out going in, you can't figure it out going out. So if you have a probability distribution going in where you can't determine what the entropy of it is because the generating function for it is too complex, then you can't figure what it is when it comes out, period. So if it's secure going in, it's secure going out. And when it comes out, you can play with its randomness, you can play with its size, you can play with any of these other parameters on it, and you can just change how you want your random system to work or your pseudo-random system to work. Extractors also have a lot of other uses in terms of probabilistic algorithms. So these are algorithms that require a certain number of bits coming in, and they do their magic on the bits, and they give you an answer coming out that is right 2/3 of the time. So 1/3 of the time it gets it completely wrong, and it goes, I have no idea here, just take this. But the other 2/3 of the time it's right. And it's based on the random input that it's given, whether it says, oh, here's the answer, or, I don't know, whatever, here you go. So you can take less random bits. You can take an extractor that goes from a linear number of bits, or a pseudo-random number generator that goes from a linear number of bits to an exponential number of bits, feed that into an extractor to sort of smooth everything out and get it all right, and then feed it into one of these algorithms. If you use a generator that is like the Nissan generator that fools all of these statistical tests, you can say, here you go, take this. And it's not random, but it's close to random. And hopefully you won't notice the difference. Because if it's not actually random, the algorithm shouldn't do as well as if it's actually random. But here's the catch. If the algorithm does worse with the pseudo-random bits as opposed to the random bits, then you've just found a way to distinguish whether it's random or pseudo-random, and the generator says you can't do that. So it works just as well with less bits of input. And if it works well with less bits of input, then you can scrunch it down to a size that's small enough and then just run it over every single possible input. And you can do this in polynomial time because you've scrunched it down, you run it over every single one, and because of the 2/3 issue of whether it goes, hey, this is right, or screw it, I don't know. You just take majority rules over the output of all possible inputs to the generator. And if you can find a generator that this works for, you've basically been able to de-randomize any polynomial time probabilistic error algorithm out there. You have proven P equals BPP. You will get an honorary doctorate from many colleges, and you'll make fat sacks of cash money, and you'll live a happy life forever. Or maybe not, but you can hope, or I can hope. So this is why these things are so big in math and computer science and cryptography, because lately cryptography has been going towards complexity theory, this analysis of algorithms, in terms of fundamentally redefining everything. Everything is no longer in terms of, oh, you need this number of bits. You need an algorithm that takes, you know, this many years to finish. It's all about, instead of fooling or not being able to be broken based on time, so instead of saying, oh, it would take more time than the age of the universe to break this algorithm, you say, any algorithm in this class, this complexity class of algorithms, so this much time, this much space, this much randomness, any algorithm in this class can never break this algorithm. So all of cryptography has been sort of starting to move along those lines, and this is making complexity theory, which is effectively what this is, into a really hot topic between math guys, computer science guys, and crypto guys. And that's why all of this is relevant, especially in the field of security, because what would happen if every single pseudorandom number generator out there right now is broken? That would be really, really bad. So this is really starting to become a lot more applicable in practice than just, you know, some guy in theory wanking about his new theorems and whatever. This is actually starting to come into practice. And people will be hearing about this in the next few years. So in summary, I covered probability distributions, statistical distance, quasi-randomness, randomness, all the definitions. I covered Shannon, Renyi, and min entropy. I covered statistical and also the real-world statistical tests, which are NIST tests. We took a quick look at Chewbacca before moving on to the pseudo-random number generator that fools all of these government tests. I mean, these government tests are tests to make sure that what the government uses is secure, and they let complete garbage through. And sure, you can fingerprint them, but you can always make up something new that does this. So there's a fundamental, I've shown that there's a fundamental flaw in their method of thinking, but hey, it happens. And then I showed how somebody can manipulate randomness and covered what people can do with this manipulation of randomness and what practical uses it has as well as the theoretical uses. So that's it. If there are any questions, if somebody could, you know, anybody?
Well,